Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 1977, four teenagers were kidnapped and attacked near and on Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. Only one survived. This book is written by the first responder to the call, Missouri State Highway Patrol Trooper J.B. King. He goes back in time to tell how it was from the moment of the crime until the conviction of military police game warden Johnny Lee Thornton. His purpose is to tell the story of Pulaski County, Missouri's crime of the century, in detail and with clarity. From the first minutes after this attack was reported, United States Army, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, the Army's Criminal Investigation Command, CID, and the United States Attorney's Office worked together to bring the killer to justice. This book is a first-hand, comprehensive look into the investigation and the shocking story. The book that we're featuring this evening is Frozen Tears, The Fort Leonard Wood MP Murders, with my special guest, retired law enforcement professional and author J.B. King. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, J.B. King.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk to your audience today.
Thank you very much. It's a remarkable book and an equally remarkable case. Now, you opened this in January 13th, 1977. Tell us what your role was, what you were doing professionally in law enforcement, and with who. Tell us a little bit about this also, this Fort Leonard Wood Reservation military base. Tell us about this, where it is. Tell us a little bit about this and what you were doing and your official role at that time.
Well, Dan, that's a pretty broad question. Fort Leonard Wood was established in 1939 when World War II was looming on the horizon, and the United States government appropriated roughly 75,000 acres of land in the central Ozarks Highland just off of Route 66 at that time and established the military base of Fort Leonard Wood. It was used for training combat troops going overseas and has basically been used for the same purpose ever since. Now, at the time this particular case came up, I was a trooper with the Missouri State Highway Patrol. The patrol did assignments by counties, and my assignment was Pulaski County, Missouri, which includes the Fort Leonard Wood Federal Reservation. The fact that it's a federal reservation leads to some special legal circumstances because on the federal land, all criminal activity is the strict purview of the United States government. So right. In this particular case, the actual crimes were committed on Fort Leonard Wood, where I had no jurisdiction, but the surviving victim walked off base into my territory, so to speak, and as a result, I got a chance to interview her and start this case rolling forward.
Now, you write that the call came in at 1:18 p.m., and this was Mr. Needham. Tell us what he says to you and what you discover about his daughter and this entire case. What do you find out at that time? What does he say to you?
Well, he called in to Troop I headquarters at Rolla, Missouri, and basically told the dispatchers there that he was the father of a runaway girl, age 16, and that he knew where she was and where the other kids were. But then he added the fact that one of them had been shot, which at the time did not make sense on the initial scenario. So my role was as a trooper patrolling Pulaski County on that particular day shift. I was sent south on Missouri 17 to contact Mr. Needham and find out exactly what was going on.
You also found out around about this time that there had been four teens reported missing Wednesday night.
Correct.
Tell us about that, and tell us the weather conditions that night as well.
Okay. We had a miscommunication, or not enough information was given. I'm not sure at this late date which way it went, but we had no knowledge of any missing kids. While I was driving to the scene, the Troop I dispatchers contacted the Fort Leonard Wood Military Police and learned that four kids had been reported missing the night before. Now, it took me quite a while to get down to the scene because, unfortunately, I was driving a rear-wheel drive patrol vehicle and we had 8 inches of snow and ice on the road, so speed was not exactly a factor in this response.
Yeah. Now, when you came up to Mr. Needham, you describe him as being hysterical, and he had a woman in the vehicle, so tell us what he says and what you observe.
Well, the first 30 seconds to a minute, I don't know what he said. I couldn't make out a word he said. And he, I think, got frustrated with me because he finally paused for a minute, took a deep breath, and then he pointed toward his vehicle and said, "We'll do something. She's been shot in the chest." So I walked up to the vehicle, and there was a slender young lady sitting there, quietly crying, very well dressed, very clean, no blood in sight, no dirt. Definitely did not look like a gunshot victim. And I believe I said to her that, you know, he said you were shot. She lifted up her left arm and showed me what appeared to be a bullet crease across the arm. It could have been made by some other mechanism of injury, but it did appear to be a bullet crease. And then I said, "Well, he said you were shot in the chest." And at that point, she lowered her blouse, and she had a major caliber entry hole right near the top of her breast. And the wound was obviously many hours old. It was glazed, crusted over, and it clearly was not a serious wound, despite the fact that it was obviously a major caliber wound. I know that sounds like a contradiction, mm-hmm. but that's the way it was. She was exhibiting no signs of physical distress from the gunshot wound, but she was obviously, and I hate to use the word a catatonic state, but she was close to it. She was frightened out of her mind and, like I said, crying. So it very unusual sight to look at this young lady.
Now, what's the tale that she tells you, that she imparts to you?
Well, according to her, her three friends and herself had been spending a quiet evening together playing cards and having fun. And the gentleman who owned the vehicle, Tony Bates, decided that he needed some gasoline. And so they all piled into the vehicle and went to the gas station in their small town locally, which was closed. And at that time, there was not a whole lot of commercial establishments south of Fort Leonard Wood, so that meant they had to drive across the base to the Waynesville-St. Robert area on the north side of Fort Wood and obtain their gas there. School had been canceled throughout the area because of the snow, so they weren't worried about getting back late or anything along those lines. So they set out driving across post.
Now, who do they encounter, and what does this person say to them? What does he do?
They encountered a military police officer in a marked vehicle who stopped them and began questioning them, asking for identification. After a moment or two, he told the kids that their vehicle was a match for a vehicle that had been used in an armed robbery of the Southgate Texaco, which is on the south side of Fort Leonard Wood, and that he was going to have to take them in for questioning. Now, the two boys did not, I would imagine they were not too alarmed at this point, because one of the boys, Wesley Hawkins, his older brother worked at the gas station, so I don't believe they had any fear of, you know, charges being filed or anything like that. So they very quietly allowed the officer to handcuff them. He put them into the back seat of his patrol vehicle, had the youngest girl sit between them in the back seat, which was a bench-type seat, and he had the other girl sit up front. He then went around and started to get into the vehicle, and then at that point he stopped. He drew out his .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol and fired three shots. He shot each boy one time and had one complete miss.
Now, the reaction from these women are, one of the girls asks, why'd you do that? Why did you shoot these boys?
And his answer was basically so they wouldn't get rowdy. A number of reasons why he would have done it that way, but the sheer shock of the moment has got to be an extremely emotional impact on both of the young ladies. Obviously, the two boys, each of whom has been hit by a .45 caliber slug, is completely different. So, basically, he obtained control of the situation totally at that point.
You write that one of the boys is unconscious, it looks like, or not making any noise, and one is groaning. So, you have that situation. Now, what is this person in this MP's vehicle saying that he's got these people suspects in armed robbery? I don't know if anybody can believe, you know, especially the girls can believe this at this point, but what does this person do, and where does he take them, and what does he say?
Well, he started to leave the scene of the abduction, then he stopped and drove back a number of yards back to the car that these kids had been in. He got out of the vehicle and took a knife and punctured a front tire so that the vehicle would display a flat tire. Mm-hmm. While he was doing that, he left the International Scout running, but it was a stick shift vehicle, and neither one of the girls knew how to drive it, and so they lost the golden opportunity to escape from him right there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we didn't touch on, and I think this is important, it will be important later, I think, is that he asks if any of these people, he looks at their identification, but he asks if any of these kids are military dependents. Doesn't
correct. He was screening very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do they, where do they go? Where does he go with these women, and what does he have them do?
The Fort Leonard Wood Reservation, as I said earlier, is about 75,000 acres at that time. It's now down to about 72,000. But it has thousands of acres of land that I think the average person would say is out in the middle of nowhere, out in the boondocks. And he took these four kids down to you would call, I guess, a shack on the river. Now, at the time, the Ribidoo River was frozen over, and the shack is cold. There's no electricity, but there is a pot-bellied stove in it that you can put wood in and crank it up and actually get the place somewhat warm, and that's what he did. He left the boys in the scout vehicle out back, took the two girls inside, started a fire in the stove, and got the place reasonably warm.
You talk about, not to get into the details, but what does he have these women do, and what does he oddly and strangely say to them?
Well, he made a number of statements. He made one statement that he wasn't an MP. He made another statement that he was deserting the next day. But his actions were much more serious. He kept the 45 in his hand at all times. He forced the two young ladies to strip everything but their socks. And he then forced them to commit a series of sexual acts upon each other. And then later, after he had taken off his clothing, to perform sexual acts on him, and then he raped both of them. This entire scenario took about 3.5 hours, as near as we can calculate it.
They were under the impression, these girls, because he had said things to them like that if they complied, so there was that, they did comply, because there was this insinuation that if you cooperated, if they complied, that they would be okay and he wouldn't hurt them.
Correct. And it probably got a little more complex than that, because several times during the course of this 3.5 hours, he had to leave the shack and go outside and get more wood. And every time he did that, they heard him talking to the boys in the scout. And so the surviving girl got the idea somehow that he had sedated the boys, but she didn't quite understand what was going on. But yes, they retained an element of hope that if they cooperated, then they would come out of this nightmare, you know, alive and well.
Soon, though, they hear gunshots, don't they? We only have one witness, but they both hear the same thing. What do they hear? What does he do?
Well, at the end of the 3.5 hour period, when he was done, he made the statement that it's 4:20 a.m. and I'm behind schedule. So he had the girls get dressed again, put them back in the vehicle, and drove about another 1.5 miles from the shack, and then drove just a little ways down a dirt path, I guess you would call it. When he stopped, he had the girls get out and start walking down the path, and they got about 20 yards or so from the scout vehicle, and he told them to stop and turn around, and when they turned around, he fired shots at them. The surviving girl was hit and fell to the ground. The other young lady was not hit, but she fell to the ground. And he then drug her into the woods, deeper into the woods, and evidently discovered that she was faking and stood directly over her and fired one shot straight down into her chest. He came back and picked up the surviving girl, drug her into the woods, kicked her a couple of times to make sure she was dead, buried her in a snowbank, just as he had done the other young lady. Then he went back to the vehicle, took out the one young man that was in the vehicle who had taken a bullet right through the heart and had died almost instantly. He drug him off into the woods, buried him in a snowbank. And then he took the fourth young man off that he had shot and wounded earlier and was leading him off into the woods when that young man, whose name was Tony Bates, by that time had to know what was going to happen next. So he broke free from him and took off running, but he only made it about 70 or so feet before he tripped over a log that was hidden in the snow. And before he could get up, Thornton came up behind him and shot him in the back of the head, killing him instantly.
Now, you say Juanita didn't lose consciousness. So, again, like the other girl, but more successfully, she has made him believe that she's dead, hasn't she?
Yes. Her presence of mind, her desire to live, her fortitude, any way you want to put it, she was absolutely, I'm almost at a loss for words here. Her actions that day were tremendous, not only for herself, but probably in preventing other victims from coming up in the future.
Sure, certainly. Now, you say, too, that, and I asked you just before this to clarify, because you include in the book a headline from a newspaper that says she ran 12 hours to a woman's trailer in this 8 inches of snow and cold after witnessing what she witnessed. But you say it was 6 hours, we'll say. 6 hours. And so tell us about this encounter with this woman. What happens, and who does she call? And
okay. We don't know what time the shooting actually occurred. Thornton had made the statement to the girls that it was 4:20 a.m. and he was behind schedule, but they had no way of verifying the time. He then took them off to the other section of the woods where he shot them. And then after he shot them, he hung around for about another 30 minutes before he finally left. And the surviving young lady did not get up out of the snowbank until she knew that his vehicle was gone. So probably we're talking somewhere around 5:30 a.m. is going to be when she started walking for help. And at precisely 12:30, she knocked on the door of a trailer alongside Highway 17. Now, we know it was precisely 12:30 because the lady that lived there had managed to get her car stuck in her front yard that day in the snow and could not go to work. So she was determined to watch her favorite soap opera, which was As the World Turns. And if you're familiar with that show, you know that the opening credit shows a big round globe and it starts spinning. And it's exactly 12:30, and that's when the knock on her door came.
Wow.
Her name is Janice Eckleberry. Janice opened the front door and found what she thought was a 14 or 15-year-old girl standing there, frozen half to death and almost incoherent in her talk and speech. So she got her into the trailer, put her in front of the wood stove, and began warming her up. And for the next couple of minutes, it was kind of spooky because the girl was talking about murders and rapes, and Janice was home alone with her two small children and had no idea what was going on. As the young lady became more coherent as she, you know, started warming up, her story made a little more sense. She was talking about being stopped by the MP and him shooting them and being raped. And as this went on a little bit further, Janice realized she needed to help her, so she brought some dry clothing into the room and helped the surviving girl change clothes. Well, when she did that, at one point when they took off Juanita's sock, a men's ring fell out of the sock and rolled across the floor. And Juanita made the statement that that's my boyfriend's ring. He's dead in the woods. When Thornton had them strip in the cabin, she had taken that ring off and slipped it into her sock because she was determined to hang on to it. And now it's rolling across the floor. And that was probably the first real sentence that she said to Janice. The other words that she uttered were sort of fragments of sentences and didn't make much sense. And then, of course, while they were changing her clothes, Janice saw the two gunshot wounds. And by giving her the fresh clothing, she presented, when she met me a little while later, the image of a person that, you know, spick and span, no injury here. After she got the clothing changed and she became a little more coherent, she asked to call a friend, and Janice let her call. She called the brother of the older brother of the young man that was down in the woods with her, and that gentleman picked up Mr. Needham, whose daughter was in the woods, and they came up to get her. Well, when they showed up at the trailer, Juanita took one look at him and said, "Don't let him in." And she kind of ran to the other side of the trailer, and Janice asked her who these men were, and she said, "Well, one is the brother of my boyfriend, and the other is the father of my friend in the woods." And so Janice opened the door and called them back. And while the three of them were talking, and Janice went to the backside of the trailer to check on her two children. She had a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old in the trailer at the time, and she hadn't looked in on them for quite some time because of the wounded girl in the living room. And when she finally came back up front, the older gentleman asked if he could call the highway patrol, And she said yes, so that's when the call came into Troop I from Mr. Needham. And then a few minutes later, all three of them left and went south on Highway 17 to sit roadside at the point where her tracks came out of the woods in the snow.
Yes, so now you are inextricably involved here. What she had also said to you in this, again, not in maybe an initial interview, but you soon got the information out of her describing the person that was driving this vehicle, but a very eerie thing that she noticed a number and she said X or 237. Now,
right
at that point, you made a realization that this was an MP vehicle, but you had also called for backup from these MPs. Tell us about this horror. You say you were dumbstruck. You were went with your realization. Tell us what happened that you were horrified, basically, at the prospect that you had learned.
Well, that answer is a little bit longer, because when I first started talking to her, it didn't make a lot of sense. And as time went on and she kept giving me more details, including the description, a very detailed description of an International Scout vehicle, which the MPs on Fort Wood had at the time, my first thought was, well, that does sound like an MP vehicle. But we had had this previous impersonation about a year prior where a guy flew in from Fort Bragg to Fort Leonard Wood, overpowered an MP, took all of his equipment, picked up a payroll officer, and took him out to a deserted range, locked him in the trunk of the stolen patrol car, and basically flew back to Fort Bragg with about $50,000 in cash. Well, the FBI and CID had broken that case, and I had heard some details about it. So my first thought is, okay, we've got another fake MP running around. But then as time went on and she kept answering my questions, she gave me answers. She told me some of the radio traffic she was hearing over the radio. And the military police at that time had a very, I hate to use the word stylized, but that's probably the best word, a very precise and stylized way that they communicated over the radio. And if you listen to them any at all, you could recognize their traffic in a heartbeat. And she gave me details of that traffic. She described the vehicle to a T, including the number on the fender well. And the more she talked, it finally got to the point where I realized this was not a fake MP. This was a real live MP officer in a marked patrol vehicle. And as you said, I had just called for MP backup because this crime is on Fort Leonard Wood. I don't have any jurisdiction to investigate it.
So you call Beck and a MP Jensen. So they come in a Scout International. And what do you notice right away when the Scout comes and Jensen and another authority Beck?
Well, when they arrived on the scene, Captain Beck, I had asked for MP backup, including the highest-ranking officer they could find, and four-wheel drive vehicles. And they sent Captain Raymond Beck of the 208th Military Police Company and several other people. And then as time went on, additional units began arriving on the scene. I had basically given Beck a briefing on what the situation was, and then he stopped me and said, I want Sergeant Jensen here to hear this story because he's going to take the CID team down to the scene. And while I'm talking to Jensen, giving him the story again, I realized that he's leaning up against an International Scout, and the number on the side of it is 37. Well, that's so close to 327 that I instinctively knew this is going to be the suspect vehicle, and it was kind of a, well, you said dumbstruck, and I won't argue with that. I totally shut down. I froze in place, didn't know what to do.
Now, you find out immediately that I believe Jensen says right away that because he's involved with Thornton, he says Thornton reported shooting some dogs the night before. Why is that significant?
Correct.
Tell us why that would be significant and alarming, to say the least.
Well, the surviving girl had described the MP vehicle to a T. And she gave us the number off the side, and this number here was so close to the number that she had given that it was almost improbable that it could not be the correct vehicle. And so Jensen has just driven up in the suspect vehicle. And when Beck and I both realized that, and we both had 2 seconds to think, Beck turned to Jensen and said, "Who drove this vehicle last?" And Sergeant Jensen was the head of the Fort Leonard Wood game warden detail at that time, the non-commissioned officer in charge, and he, you know, pumped out 2 names, one of which was Thornton. And then the realization of what we were saying struck him, and his mouth dropped open, and he said, "Oh, my God, Thornton said he shot some dogs last night." And so just that quick, we've got shots fired. We know it's almost got to be the same vehicle, and just we go from what do we have to red hot suspect in about 3 seconds.
Yeah. Now, Captain Beck knows, again, you talk about this, that the line has to be secure. You don't want to alert all kinds of media or anyone, civilians or anybody. So you take him to a house, to a friend's house. He makes the call. Right away, what does he call for in terms of arrest or at least containment of Thornton? What does he suggest to do? And then what does almost immediately did they hear from Johnny Lee Thornton?
Well, the communications on this particular date was critical, but they were also compromised. When I was talking to Troop I on the radio, at that time the patrol's frequency was wide open. There were thousands of people in and around Pulaski County with a police scanner that could hear every word I said, so we had to be very guarded with what we said on the radio. And for that matter, the same thing applied to the MP frequency. Anybody with a scanner could hear it. So Beck instinctively knew he had to get to a phone, and he basically said, "I need a phone." And at that point, I came out of my trance, and I had a friend that lived a couple of miles up the road, so I took him to my friend's house, and we basically barged in, grabbed the phone. Beck called the MP command on Fort Wood, told him to grab Thornton and the other MP that Jensen had named, put them in a room under guard, read them their rights, and to ask them no questions. Well, just a minute or two later, he was told that Thornton had been in the building and had heard the news of a survivor, and that he had already checked out a .45 caliber pistol and a couple of magazines of ammunition so he could go to work early that day, and had left the building. And so basically 58 minutes after I started my interview with Juanita Deckard Roadside, the manhunt for Thornton started.
You say, too, that they immediately secured some exits and some entrances, and you were assigned to the south exit or the back gate of Fort Wood.
Correct.
While you're there, you stop somebody and you talk to them. Tell us about this conversation and with who.
Well, the back gate of Fort Wood is a little bit hard to get to, and when this came up, they immediately wanted joint checkpoints at all four of the gates leaving Fort Wood, and I was the closest guy to the back gate, so they sent me to the back gate. They sent officers from Troop G, which is an adjoining highway patrol troop, up to back me up, and we were stopping everybody coming off base, looking for a white male, 5'9", 160 pounds, you know, probably wearing fatigues. Well, there were about 2 million of those guys that fit that description on Fort Leonard Wood, so it was kind of a tense and edgy time. And we'd been at it for, I don't know, an hour or so probably, when I stopped the vehicle, and the driver was an older white male, and after looking in the vehicle, and, you know, he's by himself, I told him to go ahead, and instead of leaving, he kind of leaned closer to me and asked me if this roadblock had anything to do with the missing kids. And that question kind of, I guess, set me on edge would be the way to put it. So I asked him why he was asking that question. He said, "Well, one of the kids is my son." Mm-hmm. So that put me between a rock and a hard place. the humane thing to do under those circumstances was to talk to him. So I asked him to pull over. And my dilemma was, at the time, I did not know for sure his son was dead in the woods. Based on all the information I had available and everything the young lady had told me, and our weather conditions, which, like I said, at the time were 8 inches of snow, the temperature overnight was in the high teens. During the day, it was in the low 20s. We had a 10 to 15 mile an hour north wind blowing. And if the young man could not have gotten up out of that snowbank because of his wounds, then he was going to be deceased, but that wasn't confirmed. So
yeah,
that decision bothered me for years because basically I told the man, your son is dead, and I did not know that for sure, but based on everything I had available to me for information, the young man had to be dead.
And he was appreciative of that information. So we'll say that so that you don't have to think about that.
When I was doing the research for the book, Mr. Bates, gentleman's name was Leroy Bates, he had moved to the state of Alabama since this happened. He came back up here to visit a daughter, and I was able to sit down with him face-to-face for about an hour and a half, and we had a good cry together. And yes, he thanked me for telling him that because he really wanted to know what was going on. And for me, it was, I don't even know how to express this to you. It really bothered me that I told him his son was dead, but yet I didn't know that for sure. You know, what if somehow the young lad had made a miraculous survival and I tell the father that he's dead, then he turns out he's alive. You know, it just, you don't want to tell people that they've lost a loved one unless you know it's true. But in that particular case, there couldn't have been any other answer. And so I told him, and that really bothered me for a long, long time until I talked to him during the research phase of the book, and he was very appreciative of my effort that day. So I'm feeling a lot better over that decision.
Right. So now, right away, you write about the CID agents and the FBI working together. They work together in teams, CID agent and also FBI, Agent Byrd, Agents Matthews and Roy E. Black and Thomas Byrd and Robert Oster. So they pretty well have this sewn up, it looks like, but obviously you never know what can happen with when lawyers get involved. But they have part of their investigation is try to find bullets. You write about right away they get into the vehicle in question, this 327 MP vehicle, and they notice the bullet in the vehicle itself. And obviously some evidence in that vehicle as well. How does this investigation proceed? Tell us about that.
Well, that gets very complex. In 1977, we had a two-man FBI resident office on Fort Leonard Wood. We were probably the only military base in the country that had an FBI office on it. They were here for another purpose, but contrary to what TV and books will tell you, FBI agents generally do not work homicides. And so The only time they're going to get into a homicide situation is like what we have in this particular case, a killing that occurs on a military or federal reservation. And so at that time, the FBI really wasn't training the FBI agents how to do this. And so they walked into a homicide investigation that the decision had already been made for them to take over. Now, let me back up here a second. When you have a crime committed on a military base, normally it's investigated by the Criminal Investigation Command of the United States Army, basically the Army's Detective Division. However, in this particular case, the kids who were killed were not military or military dependents. They were civilians. And so that almost automatically made it a Federal Bureau of Investigation case. And so the FBI and CID worked together in an absolutely tremendous fashion. The two agents that were here on base at the time were joined overnight by 13 more agents sent in. And the next morning when we had our big briefing, we had 15 FBI agents and 14 CID agents available. And so one of the smartest moves in this whole investigation, the command team paired up one FBI agent and one CID agent together as a team. And that was done for a number of reasons. First, it's an FBI case, but you're operating on a military base that the CID agents are familiar with and dealing with military customs, people, chain of commands, and things of that. So putting the two together was a good idea. A secondary reason was that the command staff running this case knew immediately that the CID agents had better training in homicide investigation and evidence securing techniques than the FBI agents did. So that meant that not only were the agents at the same crime scene together or interviewing the same witness together so that their reports would be very, very similar, but also that any evidence picked up by a CID agent would be immediately turned over to his partner standing next to him and thus getting the proper chain of evidence going for later court purposes. So putting the two different agents together in one team was an absolute genius move, because in that first 3 or 4 days after this started, the agents, there were 14 teams of agents, and they had 7 crime scenes to cover and about 20 some odd people they wanted to interview immediately, because those people either worked with Thornton or knew Thornton or were the people that checked out the weapon to Thornton. So that first 3 or 4 days of the investigation was absolute frantic chaos.
Let's go back, because we forgot a very, very movie-esque and vivid scene in this, in that he isn't arrested under normal conditions whatsoever. And in fact, it's a very tense situation for the reader, especially not knowing what's the outcome of what happens with this when they try to get this arrest. Tell us about this and his conditions.
Well, once again, complex. Starting at about 3:13 p.m. that afternoon, they were looking for him. Manhunt was underway. At roughly 6:30 p.m., Johnny Thornton called the MP command building and asked to speak to Sergeant Jensen. And he ended up in a three-way conversation. Thornton, Sergeant Jensen, his immediate superior, who was also a close personal friend of his, and the Provost Marshal of Fort Wood, or the Chief of Police of Fort Leonard Wood, Colonel Perry Elder. And the upshot of the phone call was that Thornton told him, "I know you're looking for me, and I know you want to talk to me, and I'll meet you out here in this spot, basically out in the middle of nowhere on Fort Leonard Wood, but I'll only talk to you two, Colonel Elder and Sergeant Jensen, and you have to come unarmed." Well, they kind of cheated on that one. Jensen and Elder both hid snub-nosed 38s in their coat pockets, and the FBI agent who was the resident agent in charge of the Fort Leonard Wood office was hiding in the backseat of the vehicle with a 12-gauge shotgun. They went to the appointed spot where he said he would be, and the agreement was that when they reached that spot and they shined their headlights on the woods, he would come out of the woods and face them and they would talk. Didn't quite work out that way. They're looking at the woods and the headlights and nothing's happening, and all of a sudden he says, "I'm here," but he's standing behind them. And so at that point, the tactical situation has gone totally down the tubes. He is not illuminated by the headlights. They, however, are silhouetted by the headlights. And even worse, the agent who's supposed to save them, Agent Castleberry, is in the back seat of the vehicle between Thornton and the other two officers. So he's kind of trapped and pinned in. And that leads to about a 30 to 35 minute negotiation as they stand there in the snow. Thornton's holding a 45 that they can plainly see. And during this time frame, he makes numerous statements. He doesn't know what happened. He don't know what he did. He has a headache, bright lights bought. I mean, all kinds of gibberish. And they finally convince him to lay his weapon down, and they are able to take him into custody.
You talk about the self-incriminating statements, but they're not just they're very important because they're made while he's not in police custody. So these are golden. These are, you know, these statements don't require a Miranda warning, like you say, to be admissible. And he says a lot of things, like you say, about the headache, almost sounding like he's prepared for this by saying, well, I get headaches. And he talked about the trauma of being away from his wife, but they were getting back together. But it was fortuitous that he made those kinds of self-incriminating statements that really couldn't hurt the case whatsoever. But only
helped. Oh, no, they were tremendous at trial. The agents who were working the case, from the very first moments that they made contact with him, their gut instinct was that he was shooting for an insanity defense. He was laying the groundwork. And
sure,
all of these notes and all of these statements, now let me back up. I said all of these notes. I haven't mentioned the fact that his
right
shirt pocket was full of notes that he had written between the time he knew the manhunt had started and the time he confronted
right
these officers. He had written all kinds of notes. And when they took them out of his pocket, it's the same thing. You know, I know something happened. I don't know what it was. What did I do? I have a headache. I felt bad for months. Just all kinds of things like that. And so the agents were convinced that he was going to do an insanity defense almost from the very beginning. Now, within 3 days, they had secured enough evidence that they knew they were going to convict him. The only question was, would he be able to get off on an insanity plea? And that leads into a rather large bag of worms.
You say that what the prosecution did right away, though, was to make sure that he was they got a doctor for a medical examination, so to make sure he was fit for questioning. So this is an important step that they knew they had to do, and they did it,
right,
didn't they?
The FBI agent, the resident agent on Fort Leonard Wood, William Castleberry, did an absolutely outstanding job on this case. He recognized almost immediately that knowing what they had, what the circumstances, what the outcome, probable situation was going to be, he recognized almost immediately that this is going to be an insanity defense. And so while they're transporting Thornton back to the provost marshal's office on Fort Wood to do the formal questioning, he asked the provost marshal to come up with a military doctor to examine Thornton and thus have his medical condition on record. And they actually called in the commander of the Fort Wood Hospital, another colonel, to do the examination. And he cleared him. He said, there's nothing medically wrong with this man. So when it came time for trial, his defense attorneys tried to insinuate that he was extremely fatigued, didn't know what he was saying, and had no sleep. And the information or the examination by the doctor was quite critical at that point.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, for the FBI interview, he has a condition that he wants his friend, Sergeant Jensen, to be in the room also. So
correct,
very interesting, too. Now, in that interview, again, he continues and says, look, I remember stopping the car, but I don't remember doing anything. I got a headache. But he said some important things like about his mother. I love her and I hate her. So he did a lot of talking, did a lot of self-incriminating statements. But again, like you say, it seems like an exercise in trying to set up an insanity defense by saying, I know I did something, but I don't know what I did and I can't remember. So it's a poor, you know, poor opportunity, but a poor example of how you might try to do that. But he's doing it while the agents are recording it.
But it also sets the groundwork for later on for his defense team to say, okay, yes, our client is disturbed. He's confused. He's mentally deficient. He's insane. They finally settled on the term, he has a split personality, and that bad Johnny made good Johnny kill. And this occurred at a time frame in our country when you had, I think, two different books going about the Three Faces of Eve and Sybil, and both of them dealt with cases where people under hypnosis had regressed back to previous lives that they had lived, and that in recounting the details, they would say, follow a certain road to the end of it, and you will find a blue house, and to the right there will be a small concrete shed, things like that. And when the people followed up, they would find those particular landmarks where they said. And so at the time, it was quite the phenomenon. And so by him, you know, doing the split personality, you know, my other personality made me do it. You know, I'm not responsible here.
You describe this, again, it's so eerie knowing that less than 50 years ago, this was accepted in the psychiatric circles, incredibly, that multiple personalities could be accepted. Now, in this, they have a Dr. Clare, and it's fascinating you include in the book about how he does this through hypnosis, and at that time, a drug that they considered a truth serum. So he administered the truth serum, administered another drug as well, which is very interesting at trial when, of course, the prosecution has their own psychiatric expert and also, what's even more interesting, a hypnosis expert, one of the leading hypnosis experts in the country. So tell us first about this Dr. Clara and his examination and the performance, basically, of Johnny Lee Thornton.
Well, Dr. Clary, I've examined him repeatedly and talked to him and then put him under hypnosis and regressed him back to the date of the crime, trying to figure out, you know, what he did and didn't do. And Thornton made a number of statements under this hypnosis that were incriminating as can be, but they were the actions of bad John and not good Johnny. And Clary finally presented the jury that this man has a dual personality. He can't control what he did. One of Thornton's defense attorneys, I think, used the phrase that this is as crippling as any other disease out there, and he's incapable of, you know, withstanding the thoughts of the other personality to kill these kids. It gets kind of complex, and just talking about it's a little bit hard. You almost have to read the book to get the entire flavor of what Dr. Clary is doing. But he makes a number of critical things occur. He administers drugs to put Thornton under, and that became a major bone of contention later on when the prosecution expert came in, because he basically said the use of any kind of drug is going to diminish the ability of the subject to be hypnotized. And that really got complicated again.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because it's so dramatic in visually for me and the reader, because there's a videotape that he makes, and that's presented at the trial. So these are the hypnosis sessions. He administers dexedrin, sodium amytal, which is the truth serum, but then he puts 125 milligrams of ephedrine, which later, with the prosecution psychiatrist, he says this would render him drowsy and groggy, again, like you mentioned, basically negating the, or reducing the ability of putting that person in a sufficient hypnotic state, which is what that
correct
other psychiatrist testifies to. But during this, again, when people are looking at this video, and the Dr. Spiegel for the prosecution is asked to look and said, did you review this videotape of this supposed hypnosis? There are things that he does in that hypnotic state that Dr. Spiegel disagree with in terms of procedure as well. What does he say about the entire thing, and what is the performance that we see on that videotape? What is Johnny Lee Thornton saying and doing in that hypnotic state?
Okay, another complex question. So I'm going to back up to the fact that the defense made these hypnotic recordings without the prosecution's knowledge. They were not required to reveal this to the prosecution until just a couple of days before the actual trial started. So that led to a certain amount of panic in the prosecution side of the fence. But the second agent, FBI agent, who was stationed on Fort Leonard Wood at the time, was Thomas DeNouten. And Tom had recently been to an in-service training where a similar hypnotic state had occurred in another alleged murder case that occurred in a VA hospital that the FBI had investigated. And Dr. Spiegel, the prosecution's defense witness, or prosecution's rebuttal witness in the end, had been part of that case. And Agent DeNouten had attended this seminar that had gone through some of this. And when Agent DeNouten watched these tapes of Thornton, he immediately detected one of the key points of this whole case. He immediately detected that this was pure BS, because the first thing that tripped him was Thornton is rambling on about this and this and this, and somebody walked into the room and shut the door, which, you know, it should have been a private room. It should not have happened, but when it happened, Thornton quit talking until that person was seated, and then he started talking again. A little bit later, a similar situation occurred when the telephone rang, and Dr. Clary answered the telephone, and Thornton stopped talking. Agent DeNouten realized instantly that he was not under a full hypnotic state, and so when Dr. Spiegel came in, he was extremely critical of the defense's presentation of those, because he said that if a person was in a true hypnotic state recalling an event, they would be totally oblivious to the fact that somebody walked into the room or the telephone rang, and, you know, this is pure BS. Thornton is reacting to the clues given to him by Dr. Clary in the questioning and responding in kind, because he's developed the idea in his head that if Dr. Clary says, okay, now Bad Johnny made you do this, right? Well, okay, if Dr. Clary says Bad Johnny made you do this, and I agree with that, then it's Bad Johnny doing the killing, and me, Good Johnny over here, I'm just fine, and hopefully I can get off. So basically, Dr. Spiegel said that Thornton was play-acting, going along with the suggestive comments made by the defense psychiatrist.
It's very odd and unreal almost how the psychiatrist is talking. Dr. Clary is talking to him, and of course Spiegel calls it coaching, and that's exactly what it is. But it's also very bizarre, some of the things he says about the two personalities believing wholeheartedly in Thornton's explanation of these two personalities, and then in saying some bizarre things to urge him on in terms of in that hypnotic state to induce to get John versus Johnny or Johnny, Bad Johnny, pardon me, Bad John, Bad Johnny versus Good John. So it's very odd exchange, to say the least.
It gets complex, and basically, you have to follow that chapter very closely. Now, during the actual trial, The defense put Dr. Clary on, and when he finished his testimony, they put a couple of other people on behind him, which was kind of confusing because then at a later date, Dr. Spiegel comes out for the prosecution. So I did a, I guess you'd call it an editorial something or another. I put the two dueling psychiatrists together in the same chapter so that it would make better sense. You get the defense's
Absolutely.
Side of the good Johnny, bad Johnny routine, and then the prosecution comes in right behind them and disputes everything that the defense has put out about this. So it makes it a lot easier for the reader to follow, I think.
Mm-hmm. You talk about a pretty short deliberation after the closing arguments because it's pretty well not much after these two dueling psychiatrists go at it in court. Tell us how fast they come back and what's the decision, what's the outcome?
I was just under 4 hours. You caught me on that one. I can't remember the exact time right now, like 4 hours and 12 minutes or 2 hours and 12 minutes. It very quick.
Version. Pretty short. Yeah.
But the final outcome is he was found guilty on all charges. Now, the charges themselves are kind of unique because a jurisdictional issue arose on Fort Leonard Wood. When Fort Wood was first set up in 1939, it was smaller than it is now. Later on, the United States Forest Service and the state of Missouri both transferred parcels of land over to Fort Leonard Wood to help grow the base, so to speak. But those parcels of land, several of them, were never properly deeded over. And at the time this case surfaced, it didn't take the lawyers long to figure out that the United States federal court might not have jurisdiction over a couple of spots where Thornton did some of his worst crimes. And so as a result, in the early stages of this case, the United States Attorney's Office in Kansas City, Missouri, presented a federal grand jury with four very carefully selected charges. And those charges were, the first was the assault of Tony Bates for shooting and wounding him, but not killing him, which was committed on land that the federal court had jurisdiction on. There was a capital case filed for the murder of Wesley Hawkins, which occurred at a spot where the federal court had jurisdiction. There was a federal case, capital case again, for the rape of Linda Needham, which occurred at a spot where the federal court had jurisdiction. And then all four of the kids were kidnapped for the purpose of rape, which is a totally different charge. It's also a capital charge, and it also occurred on a parcel of land where the federal court could prove they had jurisdiction. Later on, the actual murder of Tony Bates and the actual murder of Linda Needham occurred on these disputed lands, and as a result, no charges were ever filed over their deaths. Now, when the trial concluded, Thornton was found guilty on all four charges. He received life in prison on the three capital charges and got 20 years extra for the assault on Tony Bates by shooting and wounding him. But the federal judge ordered that the sentences be served consecutively and not concurrently. So
right.
He basically has to serve the first life sentence before he can serve the second one, before he can serve the third one, which in essence means he's not coming out.
Right. Actually, what we didn't talk about, and which is super fascinating as well, is October 9th or 10th, 1976, two girls disappear in the same area. A car is found abandoned, and Johnny Lee Thornton was the first to advise radio dispatcher about the car. Tell us about the shooting dog report and Albert Hoffman and Teresa Gossage, 18 and 17.
Well, again, this is another part of a very complex situation. When Thornton completed his shift on the morning of January 13, 1977, after shooting the three kids, he filed an official report with the MP command that he had shot He had fired 6 rounds of ammunition to dispose of dogs in hunting area 20, and that he had dumped their bodies at the stump dump on Fort Leonard Wood. He had to account for the rounds that were missing from his ammunition that he turned back in. The official document, his name, Social Security number, he signed it in front of a couple of people, admitted to everybody he fired these shots, and that was one of the key pieces of evidence in the trial. Well, then going back several months, the night of October the 9th and 10th, the morning of the 10th, two other kids on a double date on Fort Leonard Wood, Alfred Marshall and Teresa Gossage, turned up missing. Their car was found parked. They were not there. And that's basically all the military police had to go on at the time. Now, it was especially horrifying to the local population, because especially the people that knew Al Marshall, because Al was a, you know, the sports figure at the high school, the jock. He always wore his letter jacket everywhere he went, and he always carried a hairbrush everywhere he went. And both the jacket and the hairbrush are in his locked car, and he's nowhere in sight. And nobody hears anything from him then or ever. So basically it's a huge mystery. We don't know what happened to him for sure. We strongly suspect we know. But the big difference is that the Thornton murder case with the three kids has been fully adjudicated in federal court. And at 50 cents a page, you can get as many thousand copies of documents from that file as you want. Well, the case with Marshall and Gossage is an open case, and you can't get it. You can't get any papers from it, any reports. But the federal agents who worked both of them, and they, a bunch of agents worked on both of these cases, tell me that there is a similar report that Thornton said he shot dogs the morning of October the 10th, and there is a report to that effect in the file, which I cannot get. So we simply have to take that as the word, and that word is devastating to the families of Marshall and Gossage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Frozen Tears, the Fort Leonard Wood MP murders. For those that might want to take a look at more information about this, do you have a Facebook page or a website that people might refer to?
We've established a public group on Facebook. We're using the title of the book, Frozen Tears, the Fort Leonard Wood MP Murders. Log into that group. You'll find all kinds of discussion, questions, and answer. Several of the sisters and nieces of one of the victims have posted their own heartfelt messages on that page. It's an interesting page, and you can get a lot of information on there. Plus, on that page, you'll see several different ways that you can actually order the book if you want a copy.
Yes, I wanted to say, too, this is a Red Engine Press publishing your book.
Right.
As well. And
yes.
Also, I just wanted to also say that you do put a thanks to Sandra Miller Linhart, which is the co-author of this book as well.
Well, it's a case where I wrote the book, and Sandy came along behind me and rewrote it, which is kind of complex because I have a tendency when I write to start talking, and he did this, and he did this, and he did this, and he did this. Well, Sandy broke it up into 4 sentences and made the book a whole lot more readable, and at the same time, she did not lose track of what my message was in that particular paragraph or that particular page and kept it right on track, so... Yeah, Sandy earned her pay on this one big time.
Absolutely. Yes, we didn't have time to get into the aftermath of this particular thing, what the military did to ensure that this would never happen again, but also just the effect on the community and people years and years later. You have anecdotes of people's reaction to the MPs and even fear over this incredible case with Johnny Lee Thornton. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Frozen Tears, the Fort Leonard Wood MP murders. Incredible. Thank you very much, J.B. King. Good night.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.